Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Carl Carlson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg.
Hey, Fred.
You know, Carl, you mentioned the other day that there was like a power outage in your area. And so I'm keeping my fingers crossed because it's gusty this morning. And we're in late August when we're recording this. And in the last 2 weeks, we've had three power outages for 4 to 12 hours. And you mentioned you were having issues with power also.
That's right. We had 70-mile-an-hour winds come through Michigan. And I think there was 400,000 people that were without power, and some of them for 5-6 days.
Well, with 70-mile-an-hour winds make sense. We had nothing. We had bright blue, calm skies, and it was just we're still kind of scratching our head at what's going on with that. We had some clues. We got some clues that because the fire danger is so high, they have installed sensors through the lines that and you know how electronics move so bloody fast, that as an arc initiates, they are able to shut the power off. And I mean, that's quick and it's very sensitive. And so, you know, a branch falls across the line that in most cases will just bounce off, but it creates a momentary spike, and that's enough to trip it, because the difference between it just being a momentary spike and, or, you know, a balloon coming across it or whatever, some reason that it gets a spike and it going arcing and creating a fire, is in nanoseconds. So their only option is to shut it off. And so we've been dealing with that in the last couple of weeks. And I think that's more to come. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed, Carl, that this morning, even though it's a little bit gusty, that we'll be able to get through our half-hour discussion here. So,
yeah. But, you know, the bringing this to the reliability discussion, which is, of course, what we're very interested in on the podcast, is there's an infrastructure for delivering electricity. And I know everybody knows this, and we're going to say some things that, yep, everybody understands. But I want to characterize it as we could design an infrastructure, I know we could, with the right subject matter experts, that would be reliable under all the use conditions that we anticipate, just like we would do with any complex product. Mm-hmm. If we were to launch a satellite, we'd look at the use conditions of the launch environment and work to design it successfully. If we're going to have a space shuttle, make it work over its long term. Mm-hmm. It's all the subject of reliability. So there's nothing about the electrical grid that defies the logic of reliability. It's a matter of whether we invest the time and energy and resources to design it right or maintain it right versus get caught up in the endless fix of, you know, we have a problem, let's fix it, and just caught up in that game. And in the email exchange you and I had, we used the phrase short-term thinking.
Well, that's, you know, I was talking to Greg Hutchins, who's another author or contributor on Ascendo, and he's got a lot of experience with utilities in doing risk management work and some design work and some other stuff with them. And he's concerned because most of the West was built out like 70 years ago. Lots of new transmission lines, lots of good stuff was put out there. And they were built with equipment that was expected to maybe last 40 years. And most of it's still out there. And so that's just one issue. But the idea of not replacing them on a regular preventative maintenance plan is what we were talking about. I was talking with Greg about is that, well, that costs money. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And it's that, well, if I defer the maintenance, this quarter's results will look better. And our local utilities are often, you know, publicly traded companies or have oversight. They've got kind of a, well, they have a monopoly in lots of markets. they can just defer it. And as long as electricity keeps going, by and large, then it's they make money. And that's the part that irks me.
Yeah, it's I've got different things going through my mind right now. There's the economics. There's the budgeting. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to draw on some experience from General Motors here, looking back years ago. And we used to, I remember sitting in meetings in the late 1980s at GM, where we would talk about the questions from the management was, what can we do right now to improve the productivity, the outcomes, fix the problems, mm-hmm. improve our financial performance right now, not worried about what can we do now that's going to have an impact, say, 2 years from now. So my focus was, from a reliability standpoint, was we can do some things now from design for reliability that'll have a huge impact in 2-3 years down the road. And yes, of course, we can do some things now to fight the fires and fix problems. And so there's always those two paths. And the focus tended to be more on the path of what can we do now that affects the performance in this quarter,
yeah,
or particularly this year. Why is there that emphasis to the exclusion of the longer term thinking? That's what was in my mind back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And to some degree, that mindset is still there in the electronic grid.
Well, it is. And it's in a lot of places, and and we've talked about it with, even within a product team that you're working with, is that if they're in the reactive mode, the people that solve the immediate problem and get the customer happy and we get the production line started again, they get rewarded. They get visibly buffed up, basically, you know, saying, hey, good job. That was wonderful. They get a bonus, you know, the parking spot for the employee of the month, you know, whatever. They get accolades. Where if that same engineer had designed it well so that problem didn't happen, it would most likely, in most organizations, just go completely unknown. It'd be just, we're doing a business, right? I think it's the same problem. There's two things to it. One is, what can I do now for quarterly results so that my spreadsheet I got to report out what my results are for this month. I got to show progress. I got to do all this stuff. I have goals and milestones I got to hit. And part of that is the way we organize and operate our organizations. And then the other half of it is that if you do great at firefighting and pulling it through at the last minute and closing that last minute sale, you're a hero. And so those two dynamics create this, reinforces this vicious cycle of short-term thinking. And it just becomes normal, right? People think that's the way you do things.
It sure does. You know, these meetings I was talking about at GM, and then what would really irk me is to attend the same meeting a year from then.
Oh, yeah.
The next year.
Yeah.
And they say the same thing. I said, if you would just listen to me a year ago, and then the next year, a year later, the same conversation.
Yeah.
Fred, let me support what you're saying with a quote. And I was just pulled out my book from Deming called Out of the Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you that have the books, on page 107. And I just want to share this with you because it says exactly what you're saying. It's a quote in a section called Stifling Teamwork, where Deming writes, heard at a seminar, one gets a good rating for fighting a fire. The results visible can be quantified. If you do it right the first time, you're invisible.
Mm-hmm.
You satisfy the requirements. That's your job. Mess it up and correct it later. You become a hero. And so I just wanted to absolutely support what you were saying about that, because it seems so obvious to us, but it's not obvious in the moment, because when that fire is going raging, you got to put it out.
Well, there is that, but when I first got into industry, when I came out of the Army, and the Army does have its flaws. There's no doubt about it. So my training in leadership, though, was really aimed at the long term. It was, you know, we need to train our troops well and create a cadre and esprit de corps and all these other things so that when we're under pressure, we can do what we need to do. And you can't fix it in the moment. You got to be well prepared. So there was a lot of preparation mentality for the warfighters and a lot of maintenance on our vehicles because we counted on them. If that vehicle didn't move, we're just a target. They're not very useful. So there was a lot of my initial work life involved, you got to take care of stuff. You got to just maintain things. You got to build a culture that will sustain when you need it. When I got to corporate world, I was at Raychem Corporation, and the founder had just recently retired, and his second in command basically had the same basic attitude and approaches to management that he did. And this is a $1 billion company, so a good sized company at the time. Nowadays, I guess they'd be called a startup, but they were 30 years old at that point. But what Paul Cook did was, I don't care about the quarterly results. And he just hated anything that smacked of, you know, run the numbers up for the end of the quarter. He would just rail on that. That's not allowed. We need to make good products for solving real problems. And yes, they take a long-term vision. And he just emphasized it over and over again. So did Saldick when he came in. Eventually that changed. The shareholders and stakeholders got their hooks into the senior management, and we went to, and shortly after that, the company got sold. went to Tyco and got broken up.
It's so interesting. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is that it's a choice. Organizations can choose short-term or long-term in how they set up their culture and their structure. And as reliability people, we have our preference. At least hopefully we have the preference for long term. But it can be done, even if it's initiated through a reliability program. It can help change the culture. It has to have enough support and seeds there to reinforce it. But it can be done.
This is why reliability engineers need to gain, encourage, gather the support of their management, because it's management that creates the culture, as you were describing, Fred, the culture that rewards prevention, that rewards when we fix a problem, it's not there. It doesn't have a fire associated with it. It isn't grabbing everybody's attention. You fix the problem, it goes away. The culture needs to reward the prevention of problems. To the same degree that you reward the fixing of problems. So that takes concerted effort. It takes long-term thinking. It's a prevention culture rather than a reactive culture.
Yep.
And it takes effort to compensate for the natural tendency to fix problems. I mean, engineers roll up their sleeves and fix problems. That's one of the things we do.
It's one of the hallmarks of a good FMEA facilitator, in my opinion, is as soon as the first issue comes up, somebody says, oh, yeah, that could short out. And two electrical engineers jump up to the board and redesign the circuit on the spot. And that's the very first issue brought up. And you and I both know, wait a minute, guys, wait. That may not be worth even talking about. Let's move on.
Right.
But there's this natural inclination. Oh, there's a problem. Let's solve it. And later they get kind of the message when there's 150 problems up there, potential problems and potential failure modes. And they go, oh, okay. Well, yeah, we need to sort these out. But
yes, there's really a balance, because you can't ignore, you can postpone, obviously, in an FME like you're describing, but as a company, you can't ignore problems that are existing in the field. And so the reliability engineer may get, you know, some of his attention on field issues, some of it hopefully on design and prevention issues. And sometimes it's better to separate those out. So you have one reliability engineer working on field issues and another working on design for reliability, because then it gets a little bit of space where you can do that. But I wanted to reflect for a minute. A couple podcasts ago, I talked about the Stephen Covey the importance quadrant. Mm-hmm. And I actually put some things in the show notes, but I want to reflect on that because I didn't describe it as well as I'd like to. And so I have some thoughts about it because it affects this short-term subject. So if you could imagine, and if you're a listener, try to imagine a quadrant that on the, I'll use an X and a Y axis. On the Y axis, it's importance, the degree of importance. So at the bottom of that Y axis, it's not important. At the top, it's very important. And then if you look at the X axis, it's the urgent axis. And at the left part of it is urgent, and the right part of it is not urgent. So you have a quadrant. And in the upper right hand is not urgent, but important. On the upper left is urgent and important. On the lower left is urgent and not important. And the lower right is not urgent, not important. So of the four quadrants, the not urgent, not important, those are distractions.
Yep.
So that you want to avoid those. The one that's urgent but not important, those are interruptions. They're time wasters. They're urgent, but they're not important to you or to the company.
Right.
So now we go on the upper portion. You have the urgent and important. Those are the fires. And yep. You have to put them out. So as a manager, I would like to organize so that certain people do that. So we have time left over for the upper right quadrant, which is important but not urgent. That's the one we're talking about. That's the one where you have strategy, you're building relationships, you're doing long-term thinking, things that are not time urgent, but they are very important. And I want to say to people is spend a certain amount of your time every day working on that quadrant. Organize. I used to get up early in the morning where I would not get bothered by things and actually spend the first hour or two working that upper right-hand quadrant where something is not urgent, but it's important, yeah. Important to me or important to the company. And before I got caught up in the daily activities. So I just want to share that with people and that there is strategy about this, but you have to actually plan for it and you have to organize your life around it so you don't get swept away in the urgent things that are not as important as they could be.
Urgent in and of itself doesn't make it worth doing. That's the hard part. It's a shiny new object thing, sensation. Now, I actually was in a group that we used that quadrant in our weekly meetings to organize. You know, we've got this big presentation coming up. It will become urgent as we get closer to the deadline or to the day of the presentation. Yet mm-hmm. if we kept, when we first put it on the calendar, like 2 months prior, we put it on this matrix and we'd say, well, it's not urgent now, but it's important. This is a pivotal presentation for us. This is a big deal. So it's important. We're going to put it up there. And then we'd find out that more vice presidents were going to show up there. Right now, it's even more important, you know, kind of thing. And what we did, though, is that we were so well prepared, well in advance, and that we had scheduled rehearsals, you know, in advance to doing it, it never became urgent to us until the day prior. And like, okay, we got to go. We kept it out of that urgent but not important because it, or the not the distraction ones, but the we kept it out of the just out of the urgent category for as long as we could. But it was due to planning ahead and focusing on what was important. And in the team, what we did is each of us had our own various projects and some of us were teamed up on things. And it was a resource for us. It's, as things became, were sliding towards the urgent side of this graph for the important items, it was, do we need more resources there? Do we need more support? What else can we do as a team to get this out of that firefighting mode? And so it became quite a tool for us. And it only took 5 minutes. We'd look mm-hmm. at what's on the calendar and say, oh, that's done. We'll take that out. That's been solved. That's been put away. what's new, all right? We're working on this, this, and this, all right? Where does it stand relative to what else we're working on? And so the most important, most urgent things would obviously get the bulk of the focus and resources. You know, how are we going to do this? And what resources do we need to make it happen? And then the second part of the conversation is, how do we get rid of distractions? How do we support each other to avoid the unnecessary firefighting or the unnecessary wasted efforts? And it was illuminating of how to use it. So you can use it personally and focus what's your to-do list for the day. Here, though, we used it as a team exercise to make sure that we were focused on the right things.
Outstanding. That's a good stories and good strategy. I was thinking about something that just came to mind, which is, and it goes back years ago, because you wonder, why don't you get support from management? It seems so obvious that if we do these things, and then a year from now or 2 years from now, or 3 years, depending on the time to market,
right,
it's going to pay off tremendously. Right. And we had this sort of as a little humorous thing. We talked about the mean time between job change,
yeah,
of the management,
yeah.
MTBJC. And if the mean time between job change and some of the big companies and some of the older companies, it can be pretty fast.
Yeah, well, 18 months to 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They'd rotate people. And this is a concerted effort. Okay, you go out to Europe for 2 years, then you go to Asia for 2 years. But if your time to market was more than the 2 years, if it was more than the mean time between job change, you wouldn't get reliability support. Why would they support you? They're not even going to be there.
Right.
And so we just sort of laughed about that and brought it to the attention of management. Even though you're not going to be here in 2 years, this is the way it's going to pay off and compensate for it. Of course, now fast to market has taken over. So that 2 years.
Well, it's also a faster job change and faster promotion and faster move to a new company. What we did at HP is we changed the bonus structure so that even though you moved on to a new program or you took a new role, your history and its impact on reliability followed you. And wow. So if you launched a product and you moved on and it bombed, you got no bonus.
I love it.
You know, and so it was a bit, HR hated us for it, but they had to deal with it. But the warranty and warranty accruals became a major factor, and it tracked the senior execs. So if they moved or changed, their performance mattered. Two, three, and it was, a logarithmic scale or exponential scale, you know, decreasing scale going back in time. But if you launched a product last year and it's not doing well in its warranty this year, bad news. Vice versa, if it was doing great, you got a better bonus. It was a factor in, it was combined with, you know, time to market and all these other objectives, but it was became a significant part of it. And it is not easy to manage. There's no doubt about it.
I hear you. So if you're a listener and you have ideas that we've triggered some thoughts with you about ways to move from short-term to long-term thinking or ways to manage it or some stories you'd like to share, please let us know because we would like to explore this further. And we definitely listen to people. Fred, how do they get in touch?
The easiest is over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And we have a SpeakPipe widget that allows you to leave us a voicemail, essentially, through your browser, through whatever device you're using, as long as you have a microphone. Or you could leave us a written comment. There's a form there that gets to us. And you can just send us a direct message through LinkedIn or through our email and contact information you can find on our About pages. There's plenty of ways you can get in touch. So we'd love to hear from you.
Very good.
All right. Well, I think that's it. Let's think long term. And what are we going to talk about like 6 months from now? Or should we wait till we get some responses from our audience?
Long term thinking is good.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, great conversation.
All right. Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.